You're listening to the podcast of Studium Generale, University of Twente, with inspiring stories about science and the world.
Gilling is a well-known journalist, has written many articles in different media, Volkskrant among others, and some magazines. But I think the nicest thing I saw was that he actually has a planetoid named after him. 10936, is that the correct number?
10986.
86, okay. Anyway, if you then it carries Govert's name. Please, Govert, tell us all about the Physics Prize.
Thanks very much. Yeah, that's going to be difficult because the Nobel Prize in Physics has been awarded to two very different topics. You know, there is no Nobel Prize in astronomy. There's an anecdote that Alfred Nobel had an issue with an astronomer who fell in love with his wife. So that should be the reason why he never came up with the idea of a Nobel Prize in astronomy. But anyway, if an astronomer has to receive a Nobel Prize, it has to be the Nobel Prize in Physics. And it can't be done every year, obviously, because the physicist would get mad. So every now and then, the Nobel Committee decides that astronomy falls into the prize. And this time, they just took two very different topics, and they said, well, okay, that's enough for astronomy for a couple of years to come, and maybe in 3 years' time or so, we will be happy again. So half of the prize, the prize had to be split in half, and half of the prize went to James Peebles for a cosmology topic, which is about the origin and evolution of the universe, and the other half of the prize was shared by Michel Mayor and DJ Queloz, two Swiss astronomers for the discovery of the first extrasolar planet. So I will basically do two very brief presentations about the two topics. Now, James Peebles is a Canadian-born theoretical cosmologist, which means that he doesn't do any observing. He's just calculating and using computer simulations and thinks a lot about the universe. He just sleeps during the night. He's not at the telescope. He's a theorist, but a very intelligent one, and he has been doing this for a very long time. So actually, he is studying the Big Bang. That's basically the whole thing. Now, the Big Bang is something, this image doesn't show the Big Bang because you can't show the Big Bang because it's the origin of everything in the universe. You can't be outside of the universe, but it's a nice picture anyway. Now, the Big Bang is such a difficult topic. Nobody knew what was happening back then. There's just mainly questions about it also among professional astronomers, so I'm not going into the details, but the origin of the universe, the fact that the universe had a very dense and hot beginning, was a result of Einstein's theory of general relativity and the discovery of the expansion of the universe. Those two things together gave us the theory of the Big Bang origin of the universe. Now, back then in the 1930s, there was a German-born physicist, George Gamow, who worked in the US, and he said, well, if there was such a lot of energy in the early universe when everything was still compact and space was still small, this energy must still be around because the universe can't cool off to something outside it. But the universe has grown, space has become diluted, so the energy of the Big Bang must still be all around us. And Gamow made this prediction in the late 1930s, and he also predicted that this signal would be too weak for us ever to detect after so many billions of years. But it was there in one of his papers, and everybody forgot about it. Until the mid-1960s, because then space flight had took flight, so to say, and the telephone company of the Bell Labs in the US, they had a communication satellite in orbit around the Earth, and they had two electrical engineers who had to set up this big horn antenna to receive the signals from this telecommunication satellite and to tweak everything for a good reception. And the two engineers were Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson. They didn't know too much about astronomy or whatever. They knew about electrical circuits. And they had a hiss in their radio antenna, and they couldn't find the cause of it. Well, there have been written many books about this whole thing. It's a beautiful discovery, so I don't have the time to go into the details, but they didn't know what that radio hiss was, what it possibly could be. They excluded every possible solution, and they were at a loss. Meanwhile, just a few kilometers away on the same road, there was a theoretical Institute of the University of Princeton. And there were a couple of physicists back there who were working on this old Gamow prediction of this radiation from the Big Bang. And they said, well, Gamow said we could never detect it, but these days we have very sensitive receivers. Maybe it is possible. And they were building a receiver to look for the cosmic background radiation, as it was called. And those physicists were mainly Robert Dickey, his colleague Ed Groth. Together, they had been working on cosmology for a long time. And he had two PhD students, David Wilkinson and James Peebles, normally known as Jim, by the way, so I will call him Jim. And Jim Peebles was part of this team who set up this receiver and tried to see the afterglow of the Big Bang. And before they were successful, they heard about this detection from the radio engineers, and they realized they have detected it already. It was exactly at the characteristics that they had predicted. So that was in 1965, and it was a big boost for our belief in the Big Bang theory, because we actually saw the afterglow of it. Until that time, cosmology was a very vague, hand-waving science. You couldn't do any measurements on the origin or the evolution of the universe, so it was just as vague as philosophy, in a sense. Nobody took it very serious. But after the detection of the cosmic microwave background, suddenly we had something that was a signal from the Big Bang. We could study it. We could relate it to how the universe looked at it this time. And Jim Peebles was thinking about this, and he realized that if you look around at the universe today, we see, and he had done this measurement, he had worked with the data, and he had seen that there was not a general distribution of galaxies in the universe. It was not very homogeneous distributed, but the galaxies were condensed in clusters and filaments and all kinds of structures. And he realized that if that is the case right now, then the cosmic microwave background should also show certain patterns, because if the primordial matter in the universe had been very homogeneous, very isotropic, then we would live in a very unstructured universe where the matter was distributed very evenly. So if it's not distributed evenly now, it cannot have been distributed evenly in the very beginning. So you should see minute patterns in the cosmic microwave background. And Peebles predicted that we should see these patterns if we had sensitive enough equipment. And he also said, if we see those patterns in the microwave background from 14 billion years ago and we compare it to the current structure of the universe, one has to follow from the other. So it tells us something about the evolution and the characteristics of the universe. That was a big insight. Now, the very first measurements of that cosmic microwave background in detail were carried out in the early 90s, in 1990 actually, by a NASA satellite. And this was the map of the cosmic microwave background, the whole sky in one picture, and there are certain temperature differences which are on the order of 1/10,000th of a degree, and the temperature of the microwave background is just a few degrees above absolute zero. So this was a very sensitive measurement, but it already showed some patterns and some detail. And based on this information, Peebles was able, and he was not the only one, but he had set the stage for this discovery. They were able to look at these patterns and deduce from that a lot of things about the evolution of the universe, because you had to compare it with how the universe looks like right now. And one of their important discoveries from this first measurement was there must be much more gravitating matter in the universe than we could see by the eye. And that was not completely new, because in the 1970s, astronomers had already detected this so-called dark matter. They had measured the gravitational influence of things they could not see in the outer parts of rotating spiral galaxies. Things were moving too fast, so there must be more matter than the eye can see. And there was a whole theory about the existence of dark matter, although nobody knew what it could be, and nobody still knows what it can be. But you see the effects of it, and now it suddenly makes sense by looking at the cosmic microwave background. And today we have a much better picture. This is exactly the same map, but with a newer European satellite presented a couple of years ago. And looking at these structures in very much detail and looking at the statistics of the distribution of the hot and cold spots in the background radiation, it is possible to deduce a lot of information about the characteristics of the universe. So you basically look at how big the spots are, how big are the temperature differences, how many small spots, how many large spots, how are they distributed on the sky, and it gives you a lot of information. Now, this is a thing that came up from these discoveries, because now the idea is that the matter in the early universe was mostly dark, and on the places where it's visualized here as black, but actually you cannot see it, but where the dark matter is concentrated most, there the normal matter condenses and forms the stars and the galaxies. So this explains the distribution of matter in the universe. Then there was something else in 1998. People discovered that the universe is not expanding at a normal, regular rate, and it's also not slowing down, it's actually speeding up. And that was a fantastic and unexpected discovery. They discovered that by studying supernova explosions like the one on this picture, and they realized that this dark energy, as they call it, is speeding up the acceleration of the universe, the expansion of the universe. And this is also something that can be seen in the distribution of the cold and dark spots in the cosmic background radiation. So here's a shot, a still from a computer simulation of the evolution of the universe. And what people are doing now, and now cosmology has become an exact science, what they are doing now, they start with the properties of the cosmic microwave background. They know that was the beginning. They know what the current universe looks like, and they try every kind of properties of the universe, and they do computer simulations to evolve the universe from back then to the current situation, and they realize that the only thing how they can connect these two, the microwave background and the current universe, is by adding a lot of dark matter and a lot of dark energy. And that's not only the work of Jim Peebles, but he was a very important initiator of it. And this is the unexpected result of it. This is the composition of the universe according to current cosmology. Ordinary matter, like atoms and molecules, is just 5% of the total content of the universe. Dark matter, which we know nothing about, we don't know what it is almost 27% of the total. And dark energy is almost 70% of the total. And the total matter energy content of the universe is distributed like this. So if a cosmologist says to you, we almost know about how the universe is constructed, they are bragging, because we don't know what dark energy is, we don't know what dark matter is. This is all we understand. And the funny thing is, we know that it exists and we know how important it must be, otherwise the observations don't make sense. Because Jim Peebles was such an important initiator of this whole field, he got his Nobel Prize, not for one particular discovery, but for turning cosmology into an exact science. Thank you.
Because we're now going to switch topics.
Now, the second part of the Nobel Prize in Physics 2019 was awarded to Michel Mayor here on the right and Didier Queloz on the left, two Swiss astronomers, for their discovery of the first planet orbiting another star. And that's very easy to understand. The Sun is a star with eight planets orbiting around it. We see billions of stars in the universe. Do they have planets? Yes or no? We never knew. Christian Huygens in the Netherlands already thought about it. He thought it was very logical to assume that. He also thought they would never be able to see them, just like George Gamow, right? People think about it and they predict we will never be able to observe that, but it always is being observed. So they found the first convincing evidence. And people had thought about the existence of planets orbiting other stars, but you cannot see them. Because if you imagine our Earth is in diameter 1% of the diameter of the Sun. So if you are far away from the Sun is just a bright point of light, because it produces light and heat itself. And the Earth is invisible, small and cold, close to it. And the only way to see it is because it reflects a tiny amount of just that part of sunlight that is hitting this tiny planet. So it's about a billion or 10 billion times fainter than the star. And when the star is far away, the planet is very nearby in your field of view, so it's just washed away by the light of the star, so you cannot see it. But there's a trick around it. Okay, they did this discovery with a moderate telescope in the Provence, in southern France. It's a beautiful surroundings, a nice old-fashioned telescope. This was not a big observatory at all, but it had a very sensitive instrument that I will discuss later. And obviously, when you think about planets orbiting a star, as in this picture, this is just a drawing, the star is there in the background, you see one, two, three, four, five planets, one in the foreground, and that's why it looks so big. And then you would imagine that just like in our solar system, all the planets go around the sun in circular orbits, or almost circular. But here's the trick. The star is here. The star has much more mass than the planet, so the planet is orbiting the star because of the gravity of the star. But the planet also has a little bit gravity, so it also pulls on the star a little bit. And that means that they are actually orbiting around a common center of mass, as in this little movie. Here's the common center of mass of the star and the planet. The planet orbits around the star, but the star also wobbles a little bit because of the mass of the planet. The more massive the planet and the closer it is to the star, the faster and more conspicuous is the motion and the wobbling of the star. So when you look at a star, you don't need to see the planet to realize it's there. You only have to see the wobbling of this star. And this is how it's done. Here again, the common center of mass. Here's the orbit of the unseen planet. This is the star moving. It's not two stars, it's just shown on two different locations. The star moving in a smaller orbit, but when the star is coming towards us on its small orbit, its light is Doppler shifted to a little bit shorter wavelength, a little bit bluer, and when it's moving away from us, the light waves are stretched a little bit and we see the star a little bit redder. Now, this is not something that you can see in the eye. You don't see a star change from blue to red and back again. But if you look at the so-called spectrum of the star, you stretch the light across all the colors of the rainbow, and in this spectrum are certain dark lines because of the absorptional effects of gases in the stars. That's the fingerprint of the elements in the star's atmosphere. And we all know exactly at which frequencies and which colors and which wavelengths these lines should appear. But when the star is moving towards us and away from us, we see the lines wobble a little bit to and fro. So that's the way you could discover the wobbling of a star. And it was known all along because we know of binary stars that are orbiting around each other. And when you look at one star, you see this Doppler effect very clearly. So the challenge was to see the Doppler effect induced by a planet, not by a companion star, which is massive, but by a low-mass planet. And nobody thought it would be that easy. Major and Queloz were not actually looking for planets. They were studying very close, low-mass binary stars, because nobody knew that planets, what kind of planets there might be. But the discovery was unexpected, because here's the measurement, here's the velocity from the star towards us and away from us. It's a nice sinusoidal curve, and here's the time, and you can see that in one particular amount of time, just a few days, the star is moving towards us, away from us, towards us, away from us. This is the name of the star, 51 Pegasus, and a very nice demonstration of this effect. But the funny thing is, if you know the mass of the star, which you can deduce from looking at the starlight, you know how massive the star is, and you see what the orbital period of this companion is, you also know what the distance of the companion is. You know how far away it is. And then when you see how fast the star is moving away from you and towards you, you can calculate the mass of the companion. It's a very easy high school level type of calculation. And the result was that this companion was about the size and the mass of our planet Jupiter. So that's definitely not a star, that's a planetary object. Maybe 50% more massive or something like that, but very, very low mass, evidently a planetary companion. But then the other thing was, how can a planet like Jupiter orbit in an orbit with a period of just 4 days? That was unheard of, because in our solar system, the closest in planet is Mercury, takes 3 months to orbit the sun. Our Earth takes 1 year. Jupiter, the massive planets which form in the outskirts of our solar system, takes almost 12 years. So this was completely unexpected. And that's why nobody believed this result at first. Everybody thought they were doing something wrong in their analysis or in their observations. Nobody believed it. But very soon it was confirmed by other teams. Actually, this graph is from another team. And many more of these planets were found. But you must realize that it's a very strange system with a massive, a Jupiter-like object, massive for a planet, but orbiting very close to a star. So it took a while before this became accepted by everyone. And we now know that these are actually the exceptions in the extrasolar planet regime. We know of lots of these hot Jupiters, but it's not because they are so frequent. They are rare, but they're so easy to spot because the hot Jupiters create a big wobble in the star, and you don't have to wait that long to see the wobble. So they're sticking out like sore thumbs, like pick me, I am easy to spot. So we first find the rare hot Jupiters, and later on we found many more other extrasolar planets. The publication in Nature was in November 1995. There's a story to that too, which is nice to tell, because Major and Coelho presented their result at a professional conference in October of that year in Italy, and Nature had already accepted their paper, and they said, you cannot talk to anyone about this except to your colleagues. But rumors had spread, and the room in which they presented it to their colleagues was chock full with journalists, so everybody was there to report on the story. But they were Swiss people, so they were very obedient. So they did not talk to journalists too. And that was too bad, actually, because all the newspaper stories had just quotes from American astronomers and not from the real discoverers. A little bit sad, but eventually they got all the credit for the discovery, obviously. Now, this wobbling motion is one way to find extrasolar planets, and it's not the only one. Because if you look at a star, and we could see it like this in our telescope, we can't, every telescope sees a star just like a pinprick of light, but if you could see it like this, and the orientation of the orbit of the planet is very convenient, that we look from the side to it, we see the planet pass in front of the star every orbit. And that's called a transit, and that's another way to detect planets, because you don't see it like this, but when the planet is in front of the star, it blocks a small amount of starlight, and you see the brightness of the star dip a little bit. And every orbit, you see this effect again. Now, that's a way in which the Kepler spacecraft has detected some thousands of those extrasolar planets, almost half of the ones known so far. Kepler looked at 150,000 stars at the same time and measured, and every 30 minutes, it measured the brightness of these 150,000 stars to a very high accuracy, and then computer algorithms sifted through all the data and found the events in which planets were crossing in front of the star. So we now know of over 4,000 extrasolar planets in all possible sizes and masses, and this is just part of our total inventory so far. We also know that the smaller ones are much more numerous than the massive ones. And that's very normal. In nature, it's always like that. I mean, there's more bacteria than elephants on the Earth. There's more grains of sand than big boulders on the beach. And there's more small planets in the universe than large planets. It's always like that. And that means that even though they are harder to detect by any mechanism, by any detection technique, they're harder to detect. We are starting to find them, and we know they are very numerous. So we know that the number of Earth-like planets is really huge. The Kepler spacecraft has given us the statistics to extrapolate all over the Milky Way, and we now have an indication that at least half of all the stars in the Milky Way, that's 200 billion, that's the half of the total, at least the half of all the stars in the Milky Way is accompanied by at least one planet. So that's about a couple hundred billion planets in our Milky Way galaxy. And looking at the mass distribution, we know there must be at least some 20 billion planets in our Milky Way galaxy that are comparable to Earth in terms of size, mass, location from the star, temperature, opportunities for life, for water, whatever. So this is a very important topic, and that's the reason why it has finally received this Nobel Prize. So here's a picture of an Earth-like planet. We can only speculate about it. We have not detected water or life yet, but it will not be that long. Because in Chile, the construction has begun of this big telescope with a mirror almost 40 meters in diameter. And this telescope will be operational 5 years from now, and it will be able to detect this biosignatures on an Earth-like planet. And this is how it works. Most of the light of the star will arrive in your telescope undisturbed. No problem, whatever. It looks normal as always. A small part of the light from the star is blocked by the planet, because the planet is in front of it. That's how we discovered the planet in the first place. But a very, very tiny amount of starlight will eventually reach your telescope, but it will first pass through the atmosphere of the planet. And the atmosphere of the planet leaves a spectroscopic signature in this tiny part of the starlight. And the huge telescopes will be able to see this filtering effect, this spectroscopic absorption effect of the atmosphere, and we will be able to say what kind of molecules are in the atmosphere of the planet. And if we find a funny combination like our own terrestrial atmosphere, like oxygen and ozone and methane, we know for sure there must be a biological activity. If we find something else which is very weird, we have to start to think hard. And if we don't find it at all, we will not have found extraterrestrial life yet, but we will keep on looking. And that's the status of exoplanet research. Thank you.